Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Today we begin to talk about birth. Birth is the immediate condition for this mass of suffering in the chain of dependent co-arising. As the Buddha says, Because of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise. Birth is what we think it is, a biological process that begins, at least in the familiar human and animal realms, a single life of a psychophysical organism in a particular environment. In the Buddhist context, it's also understood as repeated birth, or the round of life and death that we call samsara. The idea is that we live one life, die, and then are reborn into another life over and over again, and that we've been doing this from beginningless time and will continue to do this indefinitely into the future, but for our practice. Birth is jati in Pali, which is generally used to refer to the initial event in the context of a single life. In the context of samsara, it becomes equivalent to rebirth. Rebirth is more commonly punabhava, puna again plus bhava, becoming. But perhaps the Buddha chose jati here rather than punabhava in order to distinguish it clearly from its conditioning link, bhava, becoming, the topic of the talks on the next link of dependent co-arising. Samsara means faring on, circulation, or returning again and again, generally in reference to living one life after another. Dependent co-arising clarifies how samsara is possible with no actual entity, a self, soul, or me, to pass from one life to another. Samsara is regarded as undesirable because as long as we are stuck in samsara, we are stuck in amassing the suffering of the last two talks. Although samsara is defined in terms of rebirth, it seems to be something felt in this life as the entanglement that we can't seem to free ourselves from. We talk about the rat race or say, "Stop the world, I want to get off." We might call samsara the soap opera of life. We seem intent on generating problems for ourselves episode after episode. Imagine that we've been watching them since beginningless past. Okay, so let's look at birth as the origin of this entire mass of suffering. Suffering is something we amass in a single life in the ways revealed in coming talks. But the mass of suffering referred to in the last talks is clearly suffering of samsara. Otherwise, the condition birth gives rise to this mass of suffering would be trivially true, and something it would be too late to do anything about in this life. The condition birth gives rise to this mass of suffering is like pushing a toddler on a swing. Each push sustains the back and forth motion of the swing, allowing the toddler to amass fun over many cycles. Push gives rise to this mass of fun. Tibetan prayer wheels work on the same principle as I understand it. Push gives rise to this mass of merit. The birth here is not specifically our last birth or our future birth, but any birth, as long as the chain of dependent co-arising is playing out, new births are generated, and as long as new births are generated, we will continue to amass suffering in samsara. If any birth fails, this mass of suffering will cease. Birth is a bit of an outlier within the chain of dependent co-arising, distinguished from every other factor in three ways. The Dhamma is said to be ehipasiko, come and see, which is to say it is subject to verification in our own experience, albeit sometimes only at times of great clarity of mind achieved in meditation. This is true of all of the links of the chain, whose unfolding we are able to observe moment by moment in this life of practice, except for birth. For the other links, we can study how we entangle ourselves and observe the fruits of practice as we begin to loosen their knots a bit, as the relief that comes with making progress in our practice, but not for birth. It is beyond our purview unless we have a really good memory. In fact, since, one, the present life is where our practice dwells in any case, and two, the other links, even this mass of suffering, observably manifest in the present life, and three, we have little opportunity in this life to ever see the push given to the wheel of samsara, it seems, at first sight, that we can leave birth out of the chain altogether without loss of coherence. Just let practice be about easing the pain of this one life. This is how many Buddhists actually practice, including, I dare say, most modern Buddhists. Many Westerners balk at the cosmology of rebirth and samsara in any case. However, there's danger in omitting birth from dependent co-arising, and it has to do with motivation. Recall in our last talks how suffering determines our motivation, bringing us to either confusion or search, despair or refuge. The difference between this mass of suffering in this life and this mass of suffering in the whole of samsara is that the latter is bigger, much bigger. And when comprehended, that much greater a motivator. The teaching of rebirth benefits our practice because it reframes the motivation underlying our practice, scaling it up from ending or easing suffering in this life to ending samsara and the suffering it brings life after life until we do something about it through practice. It raises the stakes of our practice enormously. For the cessation of birth thereby entails not only the loss of a single life's suffering, but the mass of an entire string of such lives. It can easily make the difference between despair and refuge, confusion and search, and induce us to take the measures that the doctor recommends, and certainly determine the wholeheartedness of our practice. In what follows, I'll discuss a bit more of the cosmology of samsara and the benefits and pitfalls of framing our practice in terms of samsara with the sensitivities of skeptical readers in mind. For the most part, Buddhism is more likely to disabuse us of metaphysical presumptions that we already have than to give us new ones. Our old presumptions are generally unquestioned. Modern people have a lot of them, even scientists. Buddhist cosmology seems to share many elements with Vedic or Upanishadic cosmology and to have some unique features of its own, but not to have been as systematically developed in the EBT as it would become in later Buddhist traditions. It involves multiple realms of existence distributed over many world systems into which any of us might be reborn. Two of the realms are already quite familiar to us all, the human realm, in which I trust most of my listeners live, and the animal realm. Hi, Fluffy. Lower realms are unfortunate realms of woe. They include at least the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, and a number of hell realms. Higher realms are happier realms, though even they still entail some suffering. They include the human realm and multiple heavenly or deva realms. Alternatively, birth is described as taking us into any of three categories of existence: the sensual realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. Humans, all lower beings, and many deities are consigned to the sensual realm, and higher deities to either the form realm or the formless realm. Although virtually any of us can in practice be reborn into any realm, there to die and to be reborn anew into any realm, we will learn that being reborn is in fact a kind of conceptual mistake that the Arahant will not make, since with the ending of delusion, the great snarl of samsaric existence has unraveled, after which there is nothing that can even mistakenly be reborn. Nonetheless, the vast majority of beings have been reborn over and over again in this way since beginningless time, sometimes slipping from one realm into another, now high, now low, and will generally continue to do so indefinitely into the future in the absence of practice on the Buddhist path. This is, in a nutshell, Buddhist cosmology. Buddhists are fond of describing practice attainments in terms of this cosmological model, and indeed this seems to have begun with the Buddha. Meritorious acts tend to produce rebirths in higher realms. Demeritorious acts tend to produce rebirths in lower realms. However, it's pointed out that Buddhist cosmology tends to run parallel to Buddhist psychology, which has been called the principle of equivalence of cosmology and psychology. In fact, some scholars have argued that mythic elements of religions in general often serve to communicate an underlying psychology, rarely so directly articulated as it is in Buddhism, and to a limited extent in the early Upanishads. Nonetheless, it's important to recognize that many mythic elements of early Buddhism have traditionally been taken as literally true, lest we engage in gratuitous demythologizing. On the other hand, the Buddha often demythologizes these matters himself, for instance, with regard to the demon Mara, whose mission it is to subvert Buddhists in their practice. Where the eye exists, samiddhi, where visible appearances, eye cognizance, and dhammas cognizable by the eye exist, there Mara, or the manifestation of Mara, exists. Similarly, for the bottomless abyss, apparently a kind of hell realm, bhikkhus, when the uninstructed worldly makes the statement, in the great ocean there is a bottomless abyss, he makes such a statement about something that is non-existent and unreal. This, bhikkhus, is rather a designation for painful bodily feelings, that is, bottomless abyss. Also, as examples of this equivalence of cosmology and psychology, we should note that each of the realms seems to correspond rather precisely to a mental state within the scope of human psychology. For instance, it's possible to create a figurative but recognizable hell realm right here as part of the human realm, and many of us do, for instance, by habituating anger and hatred. Through the accrual of karmic benefits or deficits, a saint can create a heaven right here in this world, while a scoundrel can create an animal or hungry ghost realm for himself. The figurative hell of deep suffering we might have created for ourselves in this life might cosmologically project us into a hell realm in the next. Similarly, different levels of samadhi provide glimpses into different levels of deity realms in the early texts. The four jhanas tend to produce rebirths in Brahma realms, while the formless arupa attainments rebirths in formless heavenly realms, where beings are said to have no bodies, only minds. So how do we frame our practice in terms of rebirth? I'll begin talking about this with a small verse. All my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. This is a personal account. I first encountered this verse in one of my early meditation retreats, a Zen sesshin, in the spring of 1998. My first suspicious thought on hearing this was, oh, someone's trying to push the rebirth thing, which I had decided by this point that I'd believe in only if I could ever personally remember a previous life. Rather, I viewed practice as a matter of how I meet the present, having little to do with past and future in any case. Practice was for me like a new office job in which my task is to take documents, let's say insurance claims, mindfully one by one from the inbox, process them, and place the results in the outbox, thereby remaining totally in the present, as I was told I was supposed to do, but with the prospect of a future paycheck, as I was told was forthcoming. However, the next morning, while we were once again intoning this verse, I discovered that my eyes had unaccountably teared up and that I had such a lump in my throat that it was difficult for me to croak along with the words, and every morning thereafter I had the same experience. Somehow the meaning of this little verse had struck me to the core. Without at first knowing how or why, I was surprised that it affected me in this way. In fact, in retrospect, I can report that my viewpoint regarding this rebirth thing remained, but my outlook had changed. What does this mean? It felt as if my whole bungled karmic past, the mistakes I had made, the people I had hurt, the opportunities and energy I had squandered were suddenly laid bare and extended far back in time beyond memory as an accumulation of karmic results that now loomed menacingly and inescapably behind me, around me, and in me. Indeed, the quality of my Buddhist practice changed quickly and markedly after avowing my ancient twisted karma. The outlook that emerged with my developing sense of karmic continuity was like learning from an office colleague that the person who had had my job processing insurance claims previously had become so lazy and so woefully behind in his work that he had routinely taken handfuls of documents from the inbox and stored them in the adjacent room for eventual processing. Looking in the adjacent room, I discovered an alarming backlog of boxes of unprocessed documents, along with bundles of still more documents tied together with twine, stacked up high, bundle on bundle, box on box, and bundle on box. I recognized that there was suffering in the form of an unpaid claim in each of those pending documents. Dismay toward a bungled past brings with it an urgent sense of responsibility toward a still untainted future. I would have to put in many overtime hours on my watch to make sure these valid claims were paid. Suddenly, rather than trying to sustain purity of mind moment by moment, I was engaged in a cosmic battle with terrible, ancient, twisted karmic forces that threaten the future, and standing at the gateway between past and present, I was boldly proclaiming, staff in hand, "You shall not pass." This was the point of discovering the full depth of suffering described in the last two talks that leads either to confusion or to seeking. I experienced a new urgency in my practice as I was struck by the depth of what I was dealing with. I had experienced a profound change in outlook that framed my practice in a new way. Indeed, it resonated with the concept of rebirth, but I chose for the time not to question my actual viewpoint in this matter, rather to enjoy the enhanced depth of my practice. The urgency I felt came with a sense of this alarming backlog in my practice. Okay, so let's stop here for now this week. Next week, we'll look more closely at this idea of outlook as opposed to viewpoint, in order to understand why the Buddha found it necessary to frame our practice in terms of rebirth, and how rebirth can occur at all without a self.